Greetings. Welcome to Confessing the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. On today's show, we feature fabulous guitarist, hitman recording artist, Joe Marcinek. Let's roll! Joe Marcinek, welcome to the Farmhouse Studios.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
Yeah, I'm so glad you made it. Well, you've got a brand new record out.
Yes,
and
sir.
Can you talk about the record?
So Slink came out actually about a year ago, December 2016. But for me, it feels brand new.
I just got it, so it's brand new.
Yeah, it's brand new.
Right.
And very exciting. I recorded out in Colorado, produced by Joey Porter from the Motet, and features the last ever recording from Bernie Worrell.
Well, can you talk about how that came about, working with Bernie?
Yeah, so let me start off by saying I do a fun little project under my name, the Joe Marcinek Band, but every weekend I feature a different lineup, and it's given me the opportunity to play with musicians from all over the country, all different skill levels, and the past 4 or 5 years, it's really taken on a life of its own where I've had some very high-profile guests, Melvin Seals, George Porter Jr. from the Meters, Ivan Neville, Alan Evans, and Bernie Worrell before he passed away, sadly, 2 years ago now. And so we did about 3 weekends of shows together, and I was talking about my new record at the time, and he was really interested in it. But unfortunately, his health had gotten pretty bad, so he wasn't able to travel. So we just sent the tracks to him over, and he came up with that melody and just blew us all away.
And for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with Bernie Worrell, can you explain who he is and who he's played with and what an incredible musician he is?
Yeah, so he was the primary music director for Parliament Funkadelic.
Right.
And came up with most of those classic hooks that you can think of. And then he also transitioned into an important role with the Talking Heads.
Yeah.
So for the Stop Making Sense big tour and DVD and movie, you know, he had a huge impact on that.
So as a tribute to Bernie, you named that cut after him, right?
Yeah. So I have this weird habit of coming up with names for songs when I don't have a song. I just like a phrase or a name.
Mm-hmm.
And then the opposite happens where there's a song without a name. So we had this song basically completed that we did in the studio, but there wasn't a melody on it. And I just knew that would be the perfect fit for Bernie. And then you know, it was about 2 months after he recorded it that he passed away. I knew right away we had to call it Bernie.
We'll be right back. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the other cuts on the record?
Yeah, so with doing the different lineups all the time, it brings together a lot of collaboration, a lot of improvisation, and I wanted to incorporate that in the CD. Because when I did my first CD, which was recorded out in Valpo at the old Alley studio, I had all the songs already completed, so we just kind of went in and cut them. And there's some extended soloing, but there's not a lot of just group improv. And so doing these different lineups all the time, that's one of my favorite parts, because every night we're creating new music that's never been created before. So I wanted to feature that a little bit on the CD. And I'm just lucky that I had really great players that I trusted, and I knew whatever they came up with was going to be 100 times better than anything I could think of. So on the outro, it's a tune, Everyone Has Their Days, that was kind of came out kind of short on the record. So it was like, we need another part to this. And we just completely came up with a new spot right after that. And it just turned out really good.
Can you talk about the recording process? So you guys go into the studio with a rough idea, or do you have the idea, or different guys bring in some different riffs or something? How does the record come about?
Yeah, for this one, I had like rough outlines. They weren't necessarily, I think there was two that were like fully completed songs, but other ones were maybe a set of chord changes, a melody, and a bridge, or some kind of idea of where we were going. And so I got together with the drummer Pete Koopmans and just did some rough demos with him and sent those over to Joey. And he kind of, it was cool because he took a different approach that I never thought of to songwriting, which was more sculpting. So he took my ideas and said, hey, let's slow this down. Let's take out these notes. And it was a very interesting way to approach it. And I think it made the songs a lot better. And then, yeah, once we finally all got in the room to record, we just, all right, take this idea. And we came up with the song right there, recorded it, went on to the next one. It was a really, really fun and a unique way of doing a record. And I think it turned out, you know, amazing.
I like the idea of sculpting. I mean, sometimes songwriting could be storytelling. We start with a blank page or a blank canvas, and you apply something. So I like the idea of you have this block of clay, and you start taking things away.
Pulling it out.
That's cool.
Yeah. A little bit of the opposite.
I was reading an article about you and your band, and they said that you were sort of a magnet where you attract all these great musicians. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I don't want to be too self-conscious about it. But I think I give musicians an opportunity to you know, pretty freely express themselves. And for a lot of these guys, they have a set band that they play with, and they have their show and they do that. And they probably, as most musicians, just like to play. So when they come out and do a gig with me, it's super loose. It's a lot of fun. We're laughing most of the time, and there's a lot of room for improvisation. So they can try out new ideas that maybe in their set band, they're kind of locked into their role, where with me, it's, hey, it's just a weekend. We're going out. We're going to go have some fun, and we can do something different. And that's, I think, part of the magnet that maybe that article was talking about. And I don't know. You really just have to come out and experience one of the shows. It's just, you never know what's going to happen or who's going to show up.
And it's never the same.
No, that is for sure.
Going into a sort of situation like that, is there any way that you prepare, that you try to prepare? Like, for instance, you're going to be working with Bernie Worrell. Do you try to prepare for that, or you just go in, dive in head first?
Well, yeah, when Bernie's coming out, you try not to mess your pants or something. Right. I don't know. A lot of it, you just have to have confidence in, you know, the fact that you've gotten to this point doing what you do and believing in yourself and just playing yourself. I played with this keyboardist, Steve Mullitz, from the band Particle, and he gave me some good advice a few years back about a gig he was on with John Medeski, who's another keyboard player and, you know, way more advanced, a jazz player, just on a whole nother level than Steve was. And Steve told me that wasn't the reason he was there. He was there to play himself. And John plays like he plays, and Steve plays like he plays. So All you can offer is what you have. And so when musicians always get together and say, oh, that guy's way better than me, or I'll never be that good, well, that's really not what it's about. It's about what's, you know, like kind of what you said, what story you have to tell. And everyone has their own skills they've acquired. And so it's putting all that together. And so when I'm going to play with Bernie, I just try to draw on what I've learned and my influences. So starting with the blues, you know, play every note with feeling and emotion, you know, and then a jazz background of being able to improvise with what you've learned. And so just kind of having the confidence, I think, is a big part of it. And then just telling your story. That's the biggest thing. You know, you can study all these books and take all these classes, but it's how you put all that information together.
Sure. Tell your story and personalize it, because you don't want to go up there and sound like someone else be someone else. Yeah.
Well, and you're not going to be someone else. You can listen to all the Muddy Waters you want, but you're never going to sound like Muddy. You can take his ideas and put your spin on it.
Right.
And that would be something interesting I would want to listen to. But I don't want to listen to you sing, you know, Muddy exactly the way he's saying it.
Right.
Because unfortunately, you're not going to be able to do it.
There's only one. Yeah. How would you describe, you know, if you meet somebody in an elevator and you have 15 seconds to tell them about your group, how would you describe what you do?
I haven't figured that out yet. There's too much information to just break it down into an easily, you know, bite-sized statement. And I think maybe that's one of why I struggle maybe gaining a larger audience, yet I've been able to hook up with so many amazing musicians, because it's a little more complex and it takes a little more time. You know, I've tried to break it down as best I can into explaining my intentions. So that's, you know, what do I love about music and what am I trying to convey? And I kind of came with four things. You know, I love the blues, I love jazz, I love, you know, New Orleans and the funk and all the music that encompasses. And then this kind of Grateful Dead, freeform, 60s psychedelia. So somewhere in those four areas is what I love and what I'm putting together and putting out. But yeah, how do you break down a different lineup every weekend? Right there, you have to explain that. And that's going to take more than 15 seconds.
Right.
And then I've shot myself in the foot right from the start by calling it the Joe Marcinek Band. Well, most people think of a band as a set group of guys or girls. And every weekend I do a different lineup. So I'm bringing a jokester, calling it a band when it's not a band.
Right.
And I don't know that there's something about the way I've done it is just very organic, growing it from one level to the next. And the people that are into it are really into it. So maybe I wouldn't want to trade that for a big mass appeal band where all the people are very passionate. They're friends of mine that I'm able to talk to and connect with on the internet. And slowly, every year is getting better. And I do about 250 to 300 shows a year for the past 5 years. So the audience is coming. So maybe I don't have to break it down into a 15-second elevator pitch because what I'm doing isn't, you know, that easily defined.
Sure. When you're on the road, do you have a different band as you travel, or you pick up different people on along the way, or you maybe put a band together for a short trip or something? How does that work?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways I work. So sometimes there'll be a set band, say, usually we go out as a four-piece, so I'll bring in a keyboard player, a bass player, and a drummer, and we'll go do 3 or 4 days, and then I'll move on to the next city. Other times I'll just roll in, yesterday I played in Memphis and, just using completely local players.
Great.
So it kind of, it cuts down the costs on traveling. And also is a way for me to connect with people all over the country in a different way, where if I had a set band, came into Memphis and played with another band, yeah, you get a cross-pollination of the audience, but it's not the same as those players playing in my band and creating together. A very, very different way of approaching it.
When you started the group, was that the original concept to have a rotating lineup?
No, not at all.
No.
So I played with the band Fresh Hops out of Northwest Indiana, and this idea of the Joe Marsnick Band was a complete side project. Completely done for fun, and mainly started because of the guy I mentioned earlier, Pete Koopman. I went to high school with him, and I always loved, playing music with him. So when he moved back home, it was like, we got to do some gigs, but we didn't have a set lineup. So, and we had talked about this earlier, I had a Buddy Pearson come and play bass. And so, obviously, Buddy's very good. Also, Buddy plays in a bunch of different bands, so he couldn't do all the gigs. So it kind of just grew naturally out of, okay, who's around? You know, me, Pete, and Buddy today. You know, next week we'll have someone different. And after doing that for about a year, we started to expand and move out to Chicago, and then some tunes got together, so we did the first record, and then okay, now we've got a record, so let's try to move a little further. So we went over to Indianapolis, up to Wisconsin, and it started steamrolling. And then about, I think it was 2013, was the first time I flew someone in. So I flew this guy Steve Mullitz in to play keyboards, and that opened up a new door because he's an established artist with a fan base. So I was kind of able to piggyback that as a way to break into new markets versus a band from out of town that no one knows.
Right.
I could bring in this established artist and yet do something different and still have a crowd there. So it kind of afforded me the luxury of being able to travel as a new artist, but go into towns where people are going to know at least some of who the band is.
Right.
And now I'm playing all over the country.
Have you ever received any flack or opposition from a venue to say, you're always bringing in different people, you know, you have to come in here with a band? Has you ever had any problems with that?
Not in that way, but it kind of is a trap now, where venues want to know who's in the lineup. And half the time, you know, if we're looking 3 to 6 months out, I don't know who's in the lineup right now. And trying to get some of these guys to commit is tricky, too, with their schedules, because they have bands and they're waiting on their dates. So that's kind of a trap in, you know, nothing that's not over, you know, able to be overcome. But no, I've had people suggested that, hey, you should put a set lineup together, because like we were talking about earlier, it'd be easy to sell and easy to market. but that's not a deterrent. They're not against that. Most of the venues, once they see it, they're really excited about it because it's all these different people coming together. And then the next time, you know, if I've gone back, I'm going to bring in a completely new lineup, yet it's still the same.
Still good.
Yeah, still the same quality.
Right.
And so most venues get on board with that.
You mentioned earlier about the different components and the styles that you like and New Orleans. And so working with George Porter from the Meters, that had to be incredible, right?
I couldn't believe it was happening. So last year I went down to New Orleans and played with Ike Stubblefield and Herlin Riley, and we did a show at the Maple Leaf. And I had a local guitarist, Billy Iuso, come and sit in and play with us. And Billy plays with George a lot, so George happened to be free that night, and he came in and ended up sitting in and playing, you know, five or six songs with us. And so that was the first time I got to play with him, and it was great, but I never thought that I would be able to bring him out and actually have him as a part of my band. And just incredible. I can't describe the feeling like looking over while you're playing, and you get that smile from George. It's like, you know, that's the thumbs up.
Sure.
Or the old Johnny Carson when he'd bring the comedians
over to the seat. Yeah,
that's like, all right, I've done it now.
I mean, there's got to be some times where you're playing and you look up like, how did this happen? How did I get here?
Oh, you know? Big time.
Yeah.
And I try not to think about it because it's a little overwhelming, and just trying to enjoy the ride and know that what I'm doing is working for me. And so I don't need, you know, the validation from anyone else. It's just I'm able to enjoy it, and bringing all these different people together is something that has some meaning.
Thank you. can we go all the way back to the beginning and talk about how you started in music?
So I had a friend in high school named Jeff Cunningham, and he played the guitar, and that was always, you know, very intriguing to me. And he ended up selling me my first acoustic guitar on October 1st, 2000. And that was kind of the start. That got me going. And then I took some local guitar lessons at Gratz Piano in Crown Point. And then I knew basically end of high school, the only thing I liked was music. And everyone says you should go out and do what you enjoy or go to school and study what you're into. And at the time, it was music for me. So I chose the music business program down at Indiana State, and maybe didn't get as much of the business that I should have, but that's where my passion for music really came together. And that was the start.
And in addition to guitar, you also play some piano?
Yeah, so doing a music program, you get to learn all the other skills involved with it. So yeah, I'd like to consider myself a piano player, but maybe not quite the level I'd like to be at. But I played with Terrapin Flyer, the Grateful Dead tribute out of Chicago. I played keyboards with them. There's a bluegrass band down in Cincinnati called the Rumkey Mountain Boys that I sometimes play keyboards with. And then I've done a new thing now when I do trio shows where I'll bring a keyboard out. And so I'll do a little guitar and keyboard. And kind of mix the two and try to see if I can juggle everything at once.
So with the music business degree, are you the businessman behind the Joe Marcinek band? I mean, 250 shows a year, that's a lot of work. I mean, do you do all the booking and promotion and all that stuff?
Yes, sir. I'm my booking agent, publicist, manager, doing all day long. I'm on the phone looking for new opportunities and connecting with new people and trying to promote the band, book the band. And it's a full-time job, but I think with the nature of what I do and the different lineups all the time, it would be hard to bring in someone else to kind of navigate these waters, because I've set it up in such a way that it's a lot of personal contacts with all the venues and the different bands. And so trying to bring it all together and then hand it off would be pretty tough for me right now.
You've performed with many different amazing artists. Is there anyone on a wish list that you would like to perform with that haven't had the opportunity to play with?
That's a really good question. I've tracked down a lot of the people that I was interested in.
So you kind of recruit people? Would that be?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to go. When I started, yeah, it was more cold calling and just reaching out, mm-hmm. and emailing people. But then it kind of got to a nice part where people were recommended to me, mm-hmm. or a couple times I even got called out of the blue with people looking to work with the project. So yeah, it's in a really a healthy spot right now. There's a couple of people maybe, on a little higher level that I'm not writing off that I would never work with them, but I like the idea of playing with these legends like a George Porter Jr. Mm-hmm. or a Melvin Seals, who are maybe not as well known in a mainstream culture, but you ask any musician and, you know, for a bass player, George Porter Jr. is probably at the top of, you know, at least on Mount Rushmore bass players.
Sure.
And so just having that connection to, or same thing with a Bernie Worrell, like these guys that really affected the way we all play nowadays, because a lot of them aren't going to be around much longer. So that's kind of important right now.
I know that you said, I think, coming up soon, you have a show with Marty Salmon. Have you worked with Marty before?
Yeah, Marty's a trip. There's something about the way me and him play together that really complements nicely, because I think, you know, when he plays with my group, it's obviously not a pure blues context that we're playing in. So he gets a little more freedom to stretch out maybe in ways that I'm not saying he doesn't get to play that way and with Buddy Guy, because I'm sure he can play whatever he wants, but maybe the context around him is a little bit freer.
A little more freedom, yeah.
Yeah, and so, and then at the same time, for me, it pulls me back to my root, which is started, always started with the blues, so I think it pulls me to be a little more pure and follow that original intention. So it's cool, kind of these different forces pulling together. And so we've been talking about doing a record together, so I hope, you know, maybe in the next year or two that something like that can really come together.
Can you talk about the blues? Can you talk about your relationship with the blues, or when you started, who some influences were, or what do you think about the blues?
Yeah, so I think every good music at its core has the blues, be it, you know, rock and roll, jazz, hip hop, whatever it is. It's that intent, and that feeling, and that emotion behind what you're doing. You know, you see a lot of these players that come up nowadays that are technically amazing. You know, they can play all these crazy fast things, but there's no what we call soul to it. There's no feeling. There's no emotion to it. So I think having that blues at the root of whatever you do is going to be some kind of connection that you can feel it, that there's that soul involved in it. And that for me, I was lucky that when, you know, I started getting into music, that was something that immediately, you know, drew my ear was this, the power of the blues. So I came about it in a little round way, you know, through the 60s rock and roll stuff, Eric Clapton and stuff like that, and the Allman Brothers at first, and then was able to trace it back, you know, to the roots of the B.B. King, Albert King, Muddy Waters, and all the greats. And obviously playing with Marty and guys like Rick King and that you know, give me a lot of stuff to check out too. So that's been, you know, really amazing. And we're so close to Chicago that you can't, you know, help but escape it, and all the history that it's still here and it's still vibrant.
It's in the air. It's in the water. You know.
Yeah, and so I feel like that reinforces whatever idea I had of having this blues at the root of whatever I do. You know, going out and seeing it at, you know, Kingston Mines or Buddy Guy's, something like that, and you can feel it, that this emotion is still there, and you see these great players.
It's real too.
Right? Yeah, and so I've been lucky to do a couple of gigs over at the House of Blues in the restaurant, and a lot of times they'll have an acoustic act before the band plays, and a lot of times before I played it was Joanne Connor, and man, she just blows me away every time.
Right,
no matter what song she's singing, you hear that intent and that feeling and that soul, and it's like, The more you learn, the more you try to unlearn, I guess.
Yeah, explain.
In some kind of weird way. Well, just by like all these fancy, you know, musical knowledge that maybe not all that is needed. That's not conveying the emotions.
Right.
You know, so you have all these different scales and licks, for a better or lack of a better word, but playing all that maybe doesn't really tell the story. Maybe you only need a couple of notes to really tell the story.
You hear BB shake that one note, and that's all you need, right?
Yeah, big time.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm still going to play all the notes.
right.
Try to feel them all.
Yeah, there you go. You know, it's all in, you know, your approach and what you're trying to say, right?
Yes, sir.
You also do some teaching?
Yep, I teach private guitar and piano, although being on the road so much lately, I'm not as actively involved with that, but I still try to make a little time to keep some students going. And if anyone is interested in what I do and would like some lessons, feel free to reach out.
And, of course, people can reach out and find your website. What's that?
Yep, joemarsnickband.com. It's on the Facebook and all the other social media stuff. Mm-hmm. And the email is just joemarsnickband@gmail.com. So okay. Feel free if you like what you hear, or if you want a CD or something, definitely reach out and I'll get it over to you.
And back to teaching, do you have a particular approach to teaching? Or, I mean, you obviously start with younger people or beginners, you got the fundamentals, but do you have a certain process or a certain philosophy about teaching?
Yeah, I think especially for the younger students, just trying to make it fun for them. Yeah, I feel like kids are under a lot of pressure nowadays, and they already have enough homework that when they go to their piano lesson or their guitar lesson, that's the last thing they need is another homework that you have to go home. And then that idea is in the kid's head. Oh, I've got to practice piano. You know, that's not, it should be, oh, I want to practice right. piano. I'm enjoying this. So keeping it fun and trying to find something relatable to each student that they can latch on to. And getting into this idea of self-expression that, you know, it should be something they enjoy. So I try to find within whatever method, book or song that we're working on, something that they really enjoy about it and can get excited about. I think that's really important, and I think missing in a lot of people who teach nowadays is just trying to make it fun for them. You know, because that's what music, most of us get into.
That's why we started. It was fun. Yeah,
because we enjoy it so much. And locking on to that root feeling of enjoying it and not forgetting about that as it becomes a business and becomes tainted and we all become jaded. And, and everything else that comes along is still trying to hold on to that initial feelings, you know, when you finally got the band together and you had that first moment where everything clicked in the garage or the basement or whatever it is.
You just keep on trying to recreate that, right?
And doing the different band every night. Yeah, we have that garage band moment where it's like, it's finally clicked.
Right.
And it's funny, it happens all the time. We'll all get together and I don't do any rehearsals, so I'll just send the tunes to the guys and hopefully everyone learns them. And then we all get together for sound check and it sounds terrible.
Oh, no.
I'd rather have it that way because then after sound check, then once the gig starts, it's like, all right, we got to turn it on here.
Sure.
And when you're working with you know, musicians who've been around enough, they've got that extra level they can kick it into. And that's maybe one of the biggest things I've learned with playing with all these more established or legends, whatever you want to call them, is that intensity. You know, no matter what gig it is, you know, how many people you're playing in front of, and, you know, George Porter played in front of thousands,
right.
You know, and we did this gig in Nevada City that was less than 100 people, but you wouldn't notice in his playing, you got 100%.
Right.
Because
he's a
what
pro.
What that guy
what,
is.
Yeah.
And so when you go to the corner bar this weekend and you're playing your gig for 20 people, you should give them that full intensity, you know, because what else are you doing it for?
Exactly. I was saying just the other day, we had a small crowd. And I'm like, I don't want to penalize the people that are here for the people that stayed home. These people got a babysitter, took a shower, drove to the gig. You're there to entertain them.
Right. And also, you're there to enjoy yourself, too.
Yeah.
You know, so you shouldn't let those external factors affect what your route, you know, is that what you're doing it for.
Right.
And so, yeah, just trying to keep that mindset. And then, you know, when I do play with other players, like trying to transfer that, too, as a way to inspire other people. Like, no, give it your all. It doesn't matter who's here. Like, that's how you get more people to come, by having that experience. Wow, this band blew me away. We're going to tell our friends, and next time we're going to bring, you know, 10 more people to come see them.
So what about when you're uninspired? What happened? What do you do if...
Oh, man, my inspiration cup is overflowing.
Okay. Excellent.
You know, doing the thing with Bernie and the thing with George and Melvin and Ivan Neville and all these guys, it's like I could sell my extra inspiration.
Yeah.
You know, it's too hard not to be inspired when you've done that, and then to just go back and, okay, now I'm bored. No, I got this amazing opportunity. I have to do something with it.
Right.
You know, I can't waste this, and I feel like, I don't know. It's hard to bring it all together into thoughts, but, you know, obviously there's days where you're not feeling it.
Right.
And you have to work through that, you know. Not every gig you're going to be on, so you're just trying to make the most of what you are able to do.
Sometimes you have to dig a little deeper.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, I look forward to every single gig. I mean, that's the highlight of my day. So imagine in your position, we're like, oh, I'm going to be playing with this guy or that guy, and I love playing with this guy. I haven't seen this person. I'm going to Memphis playing with these folks. I mean, it's got to be exciting.
Yeah, it's an overload.
Yeah.
But even, you know, when it's not, and I'll do a lot of times where I'll just host local jam nights. Kevin Long does one at the Port Shop on Tuesday nights. I don't know if I'm allowed to be promoting all these
things. I do Kevin's gig too. Yeah, yeah.
And I love that because it gets me back to my root. You know, a lot of these guys don't play in bands. They just come out for this jam night. But that love of music is there, you know, and you get to reset. Okay, I just played with George on this huge stage playing, you know, top-level music, and now I'm back straight down to the bottom of an open jam night. But like I'm saying, I got to bring my intensity, you know. I don't go down to there. I give them something to play up to. And so it's nice to do different things like that to keep you grounded and to keep you your intentions pure.
your very first professional gig?
It might have started with, there's two different ones I can probably go back to. In college, I was really lucky that Indiana State's not a big school, and the music program's not that big. So I think there was only four or five guitar majors at the time. And I remember one of the best things that ever happened to me was my sophomore year. My guitar teacher was, we had just started the fall semester, and he said, you got to go down to, you know, Hall C or whatever it was, because the jazz band, big band, needs a guitarist. And I was like, I don't know jazz, and all these chords and all this stuff. But it was the best thing, because this opportunity was just thrown at me, where at a bigger school, maybe you don't get that opportunity until you're a grad student or, you know, the best in class. And so another thing that he did was my guitar professor would do these just small acoustic gigs at a restaurant. And so he brought me out as his, you know, looper pedal, basically. I play the chords and he'll do all the songs. And so I feel like I learned more in doing those gigs than I learned in college, which is weird. But for what I do, it was more practical. I learned to be professional, be on time, you know, make sure you look nice, have professional gear, the way you interact with people, how he interacted with the bar owner, you know, when you have the rude fan who wants you to play Freebird. How do you react to that? Like all these little things that...
But that's real world education.
That made a big difference, where if I went to a different school, I maybe would not have gotten that opportunity. So that's kind of, in a way, I got paid. So that's a professional gig. But excellent. Then also, you brought him up earlier, Little Johnny. I got to do a gig with him. I'm trying to remember when that was. I know I was in college at the time, and I honestly don't even think I was 21.
And
played a set with him, and Kevin Long was on the bass, and my buddy Brian was playing the saxophone. I don't remember who was the drummer at the time. But yeah, that was probably one of the first times, at least locally in Northwest Indiana, that I played out live.
That's fun.
And I remember Johnny gave me the joke, because I was really into jazz at the time, and he says, you know, the jazz guy can play 30,000 notes for three people, but the blues guy will play three notes for 30,000 people.
Johnny's got to meet him.
Oh, yeah. And I'm grateful for that opportunity. Yeah.
That's cool.
And I've gotten to do some gigs with Johnny recently, and it's always a blast.
You talked about having good gear and all that stuff. Can you talk about, do you have a special guitars and amps? I mean, what kind of stuff do you play, or do you like to play these days?
Right now, it's a Fender Strat, American Strat through Deluxe.
Sweet.
Just Fender on Fender. You plug it in, and the tone's right there. I'm working with a Big Joe Stompbox company, making some overdrives out of Connecticut, so I'm using theirs. But I also got the Tube Screamer and the EP Booster and stuff like that. But yeah, right now the Fender Strat's just that sound that's drawing my ears. I played a Les Paul growing up, and then my buddy Ryan Gallagher let me borrow... at the time, Borrow, which became my guitar, the Fender Strat, and it was so radically different from a Les Paul.
Yeah.
You know, it felt like it was this wild horse that I was trying to ride.
Yeah.
But then once you finally are able to take that brightness and use it to your advantage, it's like so expressive. And so, yeah, I love the Strat tone.
How about what's on your iPod? What are you listening to these days?
Oh, man. Driving here, I was listening to sports radio. I don't know. It's sometimes you get so involved with music that you need to just tone out and not listen to music to be inspired. But, you know, B.B. King live at the Regal, you know, that was my the last album that I was playing on there. John Scofield, Wes Montgomery, had that. You know, there's some Radiohead, different bands that I'm into. I don't know why I'm blanking right now. The Grateful Dead is always one for me that, you know, pulls it back. I don't know. I have to get back to you on that.
It's all right. It's just sort of a random question. So... I guess, where do you see yourself 10 years from now, musically?
Hopefully I'm able to keep doing this, but maybe not have to work as hard. I made a resolution to myself to not work so hard, and I've been gone every weekend this year. So,
you kind of get into a groove too, where you're just used to making these phone calls, and every day you're just.
Yeah, it's hard because if you take, you know, a week or even a day off, you start falling behind, and then also as a musician and in a band, you know, you work so hard for this momentum, you know, trying to get a following, trying to get more gigs, we're trying to play out more, that once you finally have it, you feel like you don't want to lose it.
Yeah.
And so you're keeping that firm grasp to keep these gigs going. So, I think the idea of a full-time touring band is really unrealistic right now, just because it's so hard on the off days, you know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, even Wednesday, to play anywhere as a full band and be able to expect to make money. So by doing just the 3-day runs, seems to be the new business model. And if I could do it more comfortably to where maybe I don't have to drive as much, I'm able to fly in and put a band together, that would be an ideal situation for me, which I'm really close to right now, but it is a lot of travel, a lot of miles in the van.
Well, want to make some music?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.